Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Addison Godfrey. Brian Stevenson is a renowned lawyer and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit organization that says it is committed to ending mass incarceration and excessive punishment in the United States, to challenging racial and economic injustice, and to protecting basic human rights for the most vulnerable people in American society. The Equal Justice Initiative represents prisoners who may have been wrongly convicted, unfairly sentenced, or otherwise mistreated by our criminal justice system. Stevenson is also the best-selling author of the book Just Mercy, which exposes the flaws in our criminal justice system and tells the stories of many clients Stevenson has worked with over the years. I'm joined in the studio by Brian Stevenson to discuss our criminal justice system, his book, and the work of the Equal Justice Initiative. Brian Stevenson, thank you for talking with me.
Happy to be with you.
I want to start by talking about our criminal justice system. The U.S. is the country with the highest rates of incarceration, and it's also the only country in the world that sentences kids to life in prison without parole. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we've been governed by the politics of fear and anger for a half century. We decided to make drug addiction and drug dependency a crime and use the criminal justice system to manage that problem. We could have said that drug addiction and drug dependency is a health problem, and we need our healthcare system to help people who are struggling with addiction and dependency. But because we made this other choice, we've now put hundreds of thousands of people in jails and prisons. It's the primary reason our incarceration rates have gone so high. We had 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 and 2.2 million people in jails and prisons today. But I think that is a consequence of the way elected officials have used fear and anger and exploited crime and criminality toward political ends. And so I think we need to restructure things. I think we have to start talking about rehabilitation. Our system has become very unreliable. I think we have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes. And you referenced children. I think our system has been terrible to vulnerable people, to kids, to the mentally ill, who are often condemned to long prison sentences because they are disabled, to the poor, to people of color, to people who have no power. And it's one of the reasons why I think reform of the system is so urgent.
Why do you think our most vulnerable citizens are the ones who are so often mistreated? You mentioned the poor, people with disabilities, children.
Yeah, I think, again, our system is very wealth dependent, and most people can't get the legal help they need to prove their innocence, to show that they're being unfairly treated. With regard to the mentally ill, we have an Americans with Disabilities Act that we enforce in the private sector. We enforce it in the public sector. The one place where we don't enforce it is in the justice sector. We have mandatory sentencing. And if someone is schizophrenic or psychotic and in the midst of an episode is arrested, they're likely to resist. They're likely to even push back against an officer. That'll turn into a felony charge of resisting arrest or assaulting an officer. And in a just system, you would take into account the fact that that person is mentally ill and that psychosis is the reason for that behavior. But in our system, if that person is convicted of resisting arrest or assaulting that officer, it's a mandatory sentence in many states. And I just think it's unusual to care about Americans with disabilities in the private sector and the public sector, but not in the justice sector. And it's cruel to condemn someone to decades of confinement because they are mentally ill.
The Equal Justice Initiative has pushed back on things like mandatory sentences for children who are convicted of homicides. And you've used the Eighth Amendment frequently, that idea of cruel and unusual punishment. What do you think falls under that umbrella?
Well, I think any excessive punishment should be regarded as cruel and unusual. We have some really severe punishments in America. You know, I've represented people serving life in prison without parole for writing a bad check. for stealing a $16 bicycle for really minor property crimes. And I just think that that kind of extreme punishment for these low-level offenses is not only not good policy, I do believe it is unconstitutional. The framers of the Constitution had a sense that government has the kind of power that has to be regulated. And if that power is used to punish people unfairly in an extreme way, it violates our constitutional concept. And so we've applied the Eighth Amendment to protect children who are facing really severe punishments. We have 13 states in America that have no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. We've challenged life without parole sentences imposed on very young kids, 13 and 14-year-old kids sentenced to die in prisons. And it's worth noting that the state in America with the highest number of children sentenced to die in prison, the highest rate of life without parole sentences imposed on children, that state is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has the harshest and highest rate of terminal child incarceration in the world. And these problems are problems all over. But I do think that the Eighth Amendment has something to say to these kinds of issues.
Why do you think our society, and especially Pennsylvania in this situation, has become so focused on punishment rather than that rehabilitation that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I think it's a consequence of the narratives that have been developed. We had criminologists going around the country 40 years ago arguing that some children aren't children, that there was a new kind of child, and this child might look like a child and talk like a child and sound like a child, they said, but these are not children. And they came up with labels to demonize a generation of kids. They said, these children aren't children. They said they're, quote, super predators. And we use that label to demonize a generation of kids, mostly black and brown kids. And behind that rhetoric, we began punishing children much more harshly. I think we actually created a pipeline from schoolhouses to jailhouses. We put 5- and 6-year-old kids in handcuffs. We created this zero tolerance environment, which led to a lot of kids being criminally prosecuted for things that their parents and grandparents would never have been prosecuted for. And I just think that created this consciousness that those children were somehow different. And we allowed ourselves to engage in this fiction that some children don't deserve our protection, don't need our care and attention. And I just believe that all children are children. I actually think that a society doesn't show its commitment to children by how it treats talented kids and gifted kids and privileged kids. I think our commitment to children has to be expressed in how we treat poor kids, neglected kids, abused kids. And I think our criminal justice system has not honored that commitment, has not functioned in a way that protects a lot of kids who are at risk. I think rehabilitation broadly has been something we've abandoned. Our politicians don't talk about it. And I think it's something that citizens are going to have to be more vocal about. We're not going to recover the kind of commitment to justice and rehabilitation and recovery and redemption that I think we need if we're not more intentional about making our criminal justice system responsive to the needs of people who fall down, not just this menacing, predatory beast that swallows up people in communities.
You've also talked about how mass incarceration is an evolved form of slavery. Could you explain how the two are connected?
Well, I just think that we have a criminal justice system that is very racialized. We have all of these disparities in sentencing. We have all these disparities in who gets prosecuted, who gets targeted. The Bureau of Justice now predicts that 1 in 3 black male babies born in this country is expected to go to jail or prison. There are issues, obviously, in the African-American community that are a function of poverty and distress that that cause increased criminality. But there are also larger problems of presuming people of color dangerous and guilty. And that presumption of guilt creates these issues that we continue to struggle with around police violence. And I think that is a consequence of the legacy of slavery. There was a narrative created in America during the 19th century that black people are not like white people, that they're not fully human, that they can't do this and they can't do that. They're 3/5 human. And that narrative was never really addressed. We ended slavery by abolishing, prohibiting involuntary servitude and forced labor. But we never talked about this narrative of racial difference, this racial hierarchy, this ideology of white supremacy that was created. And then we allowed decades to go by where black people were lynched by mobs with impunity, sometimes on the courthouse lawn, and that violence was never confronted. It was never regulated. We've never held those people accountable. And then we allowed many parts of this country to create a legal architecture of segregation, of racial hierarchy through the law, banning interracial marriages. And that kind of narrative, that kind of thinking is still with us. It's why I think we're not really free yet. We're burdened by this history of racial inequality that's created a kind of smog in the air. And I just think that our criminal justice system is the most pronounced and dramatic manifestation of the continuation of that long history of racial inequality. It's the reason why our courts have been so non-responsive. Just recently, the United States Supreme Court decided not to intervene in a death penalty case out of Georgia, where one of the jurors actually said he didn't believe that black people have souls. He didn't think that this black defendant was worthy of any fair consideration. He used the N-word. He made a bunch of racist statements. And now that African-American man is facing execution despite this dramatic evidence of racial bias, and the United States Supreme Court didn't find it necessary to intervene. I think that reflects this long history, this acculturation, this tolerance, this comfort level with bigotry and bias that you cannot understand without understanding the legacy of slavery.
What do you think it will take for this country to confront that history, that idea of this racial difference?
I think we're going to have to commit to a process of truth and reconciliation. In South Africa, you see a nation that engaged in truth-telling around the damage done by apartheid. In Rwanda, you see a nation that is committed to talking honestly about the legacy of that genocide. If you go to Berlin, Germany, you can't go 200 meters without seeing markers and stones that have been placed next to the homes of Jewish families that were abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans want you to go to the Holocaust Memorial. They're trying to change the narrative. They don't want to be thought of as fascists and Nazis. There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany, but in this country, we don't talk about slavery. We don't talk about the native genocide. We don't talk about lynching. We don't talk about segregation. We have regions in this country that are littered with the iconography of the Confederacy. I live in Alabama, where Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday, where Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. We don't have Martin Luther King Day. We have Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. These icons, these symbols of resistance to integration, like the Confederate flag, are everywhere. And I think that in order for us to recover from this history, we're going to have to commit ourselves to a process of truth and reconciliation. And the thing that we're going to have to remember is that truth and reconciliation is sequential. You have to first tell the truth before you get to reconciliation.
Your Equal Justice Initiative did create a national lynching memorial and opened the Legacy Museum from enslavement to mass incarceration in Alabama. But as you said, there are also a number of Confederate monuments and memorials in Alabama, too. How do you reconcile having both at the same time, these very different approaches to the same period of history?
Well, it's a new phenomenon to have both. For most of our history, there's only been one narrative, and that is this narrative of celebrating the era of slavery and lynching and segregation. And so we think the landscape needs to change. We built this museum on slavery, but it's not just for Alabama. It's for the whole country. There's no place else in America you can go and have an honest experience with the legacy of slavery. And there's not a state in this country that isn't affected by that legacy. I think the same is true of lynching. There were lynchings in Pennsylvania. And that era of segregation has created the same challenges when it comes to presumptions of dangerousness and guilt. So for us, it's a cultural movement. I think the landscape of the country needs to change. I think we need to have a new relationship to this history that is rooted in a commitment to getting to the place. When I go to the Holocaust Museum, I get to the end of it and I say never again. And we just want to create cultural institutions that present our history of racial inequality that motivate people to say never again. If we make that commitment, I think a different future can be ours.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Addison Godfrey. Our guest is Brian Stevenson, a lawyer, best-selling author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to prisoners who may have been denied a fair trial. The Equal Justice Initiative is notable for its work challenging the death penalty and excessive punishment, racial injustice, and the prosecution of children as adults. Brian Stevenson, I want to ask you about your work with inmates on death row. Mm-hmm. You've worked with many individuals on death row, and you've also raised questions about its morality. In your TED Talk and in your book, Just Mercy, you ask two questions. Do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? And do we deserve to kill? How would you answer those questions yourself?
Well, for me, it's what is the threshold question? I don't think the threshold question, I don't think the first question is whether people deserve to die. I actually think the first question is, do we deserve to kill? If we have a system that is compromised by bias and racial discrimination, if we have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than poor and innocent, if we have a system that's political, if we have a system that makes the kinds of mistakes that our system makes. We've now exonerated over 160 people who were proved innocent after being sentenced to death. That means that for every 10 people we've executed in this country, we've now identified an innocent person on death row. Think about that. That's a shocking rate of error, 1 out of 10. I mean, if somebody told you that 1 out of every 10 apples will kill you if you bite into it, none of us would eat apples. And yet we tolerate this rate of error in the death penalty. So for me, the threshold question, the first question is, do we deserve to kill? And with an error-prone, racially biased, discriminatory system against the poor, politicized in the ways that our system is politicized, I don't think we do. And it doesn't mean that people don't deserve harsh punishment for the very serious, tragic crimes they commit. It just means that we can't attempt to execute a punishment that requires perfection. You have to have a perfect system if you're going to kill somebody, because you don't have the ability, the power to recover from a mistake in a system where you take someone's life.
Your grandfather was murdered when you were a teenager. At the time, did you have an opinion on how the person who killed your grandfather should be punished?
Well, yeah, obviously, like anyone who loses a loved one to violence, you're just heartbroken and you're outraged and you ask questions about how, why did this happen? My grandmother was 80, grandfather was 86 years old. He was killed by several young people who were trying to steal his TV. I think for me, though, and my family, the question is, what kind of society have we created that allows a young group of young people to think that this is responsible, that this is permissible? And I think it has a lot to do with these larger issues. And we wanted people held accountable, obviously, but we wanted more to change the environment. We didn't want there to be traumatized kids, abused kids, neglected kids roaming around unsupervised, unparented, uncared for, engaging in one violent act after the other. We thought that was a part of the problem too. And I think in many ways it's what's motivated me to do the work that I do. I just believe that we have a lot of people in our society who are suffering, who have been traumatized by a host of challenges, and we can't pretend that those challenges are things we can ignore if we want to create safe communities, the kind of society that I believe we deserve, which is safe and fair and just.
Are there ways then that you think you have shown those teenagers who killed your grandfather mercy?
Well, I believe every person is more than the worst thing they've ever done. And I think that even for people who have caused me or my family harm, I think each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. If you tell a lie, you're not just a liar. If you take something, you're not just a thief. I believe even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. And that justice requires that we understand the other things you are. And I think that's true for those young men who killed my grandfather, but I also think it's true for all of us. You know, I think it's true for these states that tolerated and engaged in slavery and lynching and segregation. You know, Alabama's a slave state, a lynching state, a segregation state, but we're more than that. And it's the more than part that gives us the opportunity to create a different future, a different hope. And just like I don't want to take away the chance of recovery and restoration and redemption and reparation for states that have engaged in systematic violence and bigotry, I don't want that taken away for the clients that I've represented who've engaged in violent acts. I ultimately think we all need more justice, more mercy, more hope if we're going to be the kind of human beings that can make a better world. And we just have to be willing to give that to those who harm us as much as we want it when we harm others.
When I first read your book 2 years ago, many of the stories you told made me angry. Mm. And I would share those stories with my boyfriend. And I distinctly remember that there was one night he told me he had had a really good day and I was bringing him down. When you see so many miscarriages of justice, how do you keep yourself from being broken by it? How do you keep going?
Yeah. Well, there's no question that when you concern yourself with people who are struggling and suffering, when you look at injustice and inequality, it can bring you down. I just think for me, what would be worse, what would bring me down in ways I couldn't recover from, if I knew about inequality, knew about injustice, knew about suffering, had the ability to make a difference and didn't do that. And I think that's the story of this larger struggle. I'm the great-grandson of people who were enslaved. My great-grandfather was born in slavery, and yet he learned to read, even though it could have cost him his life. And he gave me, through my grandmother and my mother, this desire to understand the world. My grandparents fled the American South after being terrorized by lynching. I started my education in a colored school. There were no high schools for black kids when my dad was a teenager. And so I am standing on the shoulders of people who did so much more with so much less, that for me, I don't have the option of being overwhelmed, of being paralyzed by the difficulty. I've got coursing through my body the blood of people who overcame slavery and lynching and segregation. So for me, that means I've got to find ways to help our nation overcome the brutality and inequality of mass incarceration. And while it's challenging, it's just the nature of the struggle. It's the challenge we have to meet. And we have to do that as a decent, just society when we're threatened, when the climate is and when the earth planet is falling apart, when there are powers trying to abuse military power in an abusive way. We have to respond. And so it is when we're surrounded by inequality and injustice.
In our current political climate, with a lot of politicians who are kind of capitalizing on that fear and anger, do you believe that just mercy is possible?
Oh, I do. I do. I think we all have to have some hope of something better. And I am persuaded that hope is critical to how we change things. If you lose your hope, you sort of become part of the problem. I mean, I really believe that hopelessness is the enemy of justice. If we're not hopeful about our capacity to create more equity, to create more justice, to show mercy, then I think we are complicit in sustaining those problems. In fact, I think you're either hopeful or you're the problem. There's really no space for neutrality on this. Hope is what will get us to believe things we haven't seen. As I said, my great grandparents believed they would one day be free, even though they hadn't seen black people like themselves free. My grandparents believed that they could be secure, even though it was impossible for them to find security. I grew up in segregation, where we believed that one day these legal barriers to education and voting would be torn away. I believe that we can get to the point where we have a criminal justice system that is fairer, more just, that doesn't brutalize the vulnerable, the poor, and people of color. And the hope of that is what sustains me, and I think it's what we all have to have if we want to create a more just society.
A young adult version of your book, Just Mercy, was recently published. How early do you think we should be having these types of conversations with young people?
Well, sadly, so many young people, their lives are already being impacted by this phenomena at a very young age. I mean, the percentage of women sent to prison in the last 25 years has increased 646%. 70% of these women are single parents with minor children. So I think we have to begin talking to kids who see the collateral consequences of mass incarceration, who are in homes where there are no men or older brothers because of these dynamics. I think talking to children about what's fair, what's just, what's right is something that we have to start doing at very early ages. I don't think you're ever too young to have someone modeling for you what fairness is about, what justice is about, what compassion is about. And as kids move into communities where these issues are quite serious, I think we have to find ways to reach out to them. And that was part of my motivation in having a young adult version of Just Mercy.
What steps do you think all of us could take today to create a more just, merciful society?
Well, very simply, I think we have to get proximate. We have to get closer to people who are suffering and who are dealing with abuse and trauma and violence and dependency. We cannot create a more just society if we stay in privileged spaces. We can't just stay on Penn State's campus. We've got to actually go into communities where there's a lot of neglect and despair, into jails and prisons. I think we have to change some of these narratives. I think we have to reject the politics of fear and anger. We can't allow ourselves to be governed by that. I think fear and anger are the essential ingredients of injustice and oppression. If we allow ourselves to be governed by fear and anger, we'll tolerate things we shouldn't tolerate, and that will keep us in an unjust place. I do think we have to stay hopeful. And lastly, I think we have to be willing to do things that are uncomfortable. We cannot change the world. We cannot create a just and merciful society if we're unwilling to do things that are inconvenient and uncomfortable. Because the history of the world tells me that change comes, justice comes, equality comes, liberty comes when good people position themselves to do uncomfortable and inconvenient things. And I think if we do those four things, whether it's in our own little community, whether it's at the county level, whether it's statewide, whether it's regional, whether it's national, we have the formula for creating a society that is more just, more merciful, and restores the hope that I think we all need to become the great society I think we can become.
Brian Stevenson, thank you for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Stevenson is a lawyer who has been widely acclaimed for his work with the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit organization he founded to represent prisoners who have been abused by our criminal justice system. Stevenson is also the best-selling author of the book Just Mercy, which gives an intimate look at our criminal justice system and the ways it's failed our most vulnerable citizens. To listen to more Take Note interviews, go to our website at wpsu.org/takenote. I'm Addison Godfrey, WPSU.